Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Welcome to the first episode of How We Hope. I'm Betsy.
And I'm Lena.
In each episode of the show, we will investigate a different aspect of hope.
And we're really thinking about hope in the context of the world today. So we're going to touch on a lot of themes like climate, algorithms and social media, having kids in this time, even pandemics. Betsy, you came to me with this idea a few months ago. Can you tell me a little bit about what your inspiration was?
The inspiration was my doom and my general sentiment that living in the U.S. right now feels a lot like a live-action Lord of the Flies. It's a pretty depressing book about a bunch of school-age children crash-landing on a deserted island and fighting to the death. I shared this existential doomsday vision with you and told you I felt I needed some sort of how-to guide on surviving apocalypse.
And I was like, we are not in an apocalypse.
You said, get a grip, Betsy.
Like, you are so dramatic. In Lord of the Flies, the boys start eating each other. I do not think we're anywhere near that.
You're totally right. But as a stubborn pessimist and also your best friend, I did want to argue with you a little bit about that. And then I thought, roll the cameras. We've got a show. So in each episode of the show, we are going to dig into an aspect of hope that we've been grappling with. The psychology of hope, the philosophical connection between hope and religion, or practical examples of progress and how humans are doing better. We are going to talk to researchers, friends, and each other to try and understand hope, which is something that is uniquely complex and human.
And as you can tell, we have really different perspectives on hope. And I also think that the topics we gravitate towards are a little bit different. So I am excited to learn from you and to talk to so many interesting people. This first episode is going to focus on collective action. I was really drawn to this topic because it feels like most of the sources of doom around us are collective action problems, where one of us can't really do anything about it, but as a collective, we could make a change. But that just feels so daunting in a really polarized environment. For example, when we think about climate change, as an individual person, we could try to eat less meat, maybe like take public transit, but that's ultimately just a drop in the bucket when we think about the global scale of climate change. So I am hoping to learn about successful collective action at really different scales in this episode, starting with something as small as a local theater strike, and then also thinking about something as large as the eradication of smallpox across the entire globe. And I'm going to ask about the role of hope in these movements and hopefully get a little bit inspired. Betsy, what are your initial thoughts on collective action?
I feel like I hear a lot about the success stories. I haven't participated in collective action as much as I would like, but I think the process of convincing people to buy in almost to each other and to work together to achieve something they could not do alone is really interesting, especially when you're asking people to make some big sacrifices.
I think you're so right that we're often looking at collective action from these big moments of like a big strike or a big win or a big unionization effort. but we don't actually get to think about all of the steps that are involved at the very beginning stages. Like in the beginning, you have no idea if something is going to work. It's really vulnerable to try and get people to buy into something. A few months ago, a local movie theater near me called the Alamo Draft House went on strike. And this was after the theater announced layoffs to 20% of their staff. I would walk by them picketing, and I really felt like it must be so vulnerable to stand there, tell everyone that you feel like you were treated unfairly, and to try to get people to buy in and support you when there's really no guarantee of success.
Yeah, I think losing your job is embarrassing. I went through that experience not too long ago. And that's embarrassing when you have to tell your mom that you're moving back in with her. Anyways, I don't think you could have paid me enough money to hold a sign and stand outside saying, "I lost my job. I need your help getting it back." But these workers are very brave, and they did succeed in achieving what they set out to do, which was to get everyone their jobs back.
I guess it helps that they were fighting on behalf of their coworkers. Even if you didn't want to stand outside and be like, "I lost my job," I would stay outside and be like, "My friend was unfairly laid off."
Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot.
When I was walking by this strike, though, I was definitely pretty skeptical. I was like, this massive company just laid you off. You're going on strike. What are they going to do? Hire you back? And then they actually did. So I am really excited to share some things that I learned from talking to Seb, who is one of the strike organizers for this Alamo Draft House strike. One of the things that I really enjoyed learning from Seb was the way that the strike progressed. Betsy, we've both been in workplaces where we weren't super happy about decisions that were made. So imagine that you were in the shoes of Seb. You work at this movie theater. You all unionized 2 years ago and still have not been able to reach an agreement on your first contract. And now you're told that a fifth of your workplace is going to be laid off, including a lot of your friends and people who you've worked with for a long time. How long would you be willing to go on strike, not work, not receive benefits, show up for 5 days a week in the cold, in the dead of winter, in front of your old workplace, and ask people around you to support you?
You listed so many upsetting things, but the most upsetting words to me were "in the dead of winter." So the weather will definitely affect my motivation. So for a very sunny winter, I think I could go for a month.
Seb actually talked about this, how there were people who didn't have the winter gear that you need to be outside for 8 hours in a day. Like, you work for a movie theater, you're not expecting to need to be in the elements entire day. But the Alamo strike actually ended up lasting 2 full months. Initially, people had voted to go on strike for just 11 days. They didn't think the strike would last longer than that. They really thought that the company would come to the bargaining table. But after 11 days, the company still had not reached out to them. And at that point, people started settling in for the long haul. They were able to tap into some of the existing structures in place. They got strike pay. They set up a GoFundMe. They also made sure that people would get unemployment, since in the state of New York, you're eligible for unemployment after 14 days of striking. And they also set up a schedule for people to follow for picketing, made sure people had the winter clothes that they needed. So with these structures in place, Seb said that although some people were still nervous about continuing the strike, the overwhelming majority were supportive.
We'd already gone through the hardest part, which is getting everything together, putting it together. We're already here. We already have the systems for it. We can better compose ourselves as a labor movement.
Wow, that's admirable that after 11 days, they just set up camp and said, okay, this is where we'll be for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, something I was thinking about was how important it was that they had already been unionized. They, at this point, had a union rep that helped them navigate some of those administrative hurdles of making sure they get strike pay and making sure they can get unemployment. And then they also already had, you know, union leaders who could help coordinate the day-to-day logistics of showing up to strike.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk to Seb about what it was like to stand outside and declare to the public that you lost your job and that you need help getting it back, to interact with people and be exposed to their interactions?
Yes.
The kinds of reactions we get in public really differ depending on which location we were at. The downtown Brooklyn location is probably where we got the most visible physical support from people that were not involved. We had talked to, I don't know how many people that were sympathizing, saying, oh yeah, that happened to someone I know, that happened to me. We got fired, terminated, laid off unfairly by a company for no real justified reason. And there was never any confrontation or any fight that broke out, but people would come by and argue and, you know, try to make cases against the labor. That happened quite a few times in the Manhattan locations. Those people that come in and kind of neg at the strike, they argue against it, honestly had a reverse effect on the people striking. I know for a lot of people on the picket line who saw that kind of thing happen, who were engaging with that, were very adamant about their position as striking workers. You see those kinds of reactions from people, and whether it's good or bad, it's something that can fuel you on the picket line.
And in retrospect, I think that seems obvious. You're out here not only defending yourself, but you're also defending your coworkers who you feel were unfairly treated, who you're actually getting closer to as you're spending all this time picketing with them. And so, of course, you're going to feel some type of way about a random person who tells you to get over it and go back to work. I think it was also really motivating to get support from people, though. They were able to raise $48,000 on GoFundMe.
It looks like they had some clout. That is really impressive.
Yeah. So I left this conversation with Seb really appreciating the feeling of collectivism that you can get when you're part of a movement, and also really understanding the importance of investing long-term in these types of organizing structures. So the fact that they were already unionized, and the fact that people in the past had fought for things like strike pay and unemployment pay for people who were on strike, was so important.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
So that really sets the backdrop for my next interview with Nellie Bristol. Nellie is a researcher and a journalist who has done a ton of work writing about disease eradication. I was really excited to talk to her to learn about an example of collective action at a much larger scale, the eradication of smallpox. Betsy, as a public health reporter, do you have any initial thoughts on disease eradication?
Yeah, disease eradication is defined as no more cases globally. Disease is literally not spreading because no one has it anymore. And having spent the past couple of years reporting on the resurgence of measles, which in the US was eliminated in the year 2000, disease eradication does kind of feel impossible.
Yeah, 100%. It just feels so ambitious. There have been several other movements to try and eradicate disease that have not been successful. Like polio eradication got super close, but then there were just like two countries that didn't want to cooperate with other field staff coming in and administering vaccines. Smallpox eradication is the only example that we have. And it got lucky because it was such a specific moment in geopolitics in the 1960s. Where there was a lot of investment in new technology and specific political factors that affected its success.
So smallpox had been around for a long time and had done a lot of damage over the centuries. And the eradication campaign was started in 1958. It was approved at the World Health Assembly, which is the governing body of the World Health Organization. and was proposed initially by the Soviet Union to showcase their health and technological advances, and also to make a big splash internationally and the U.S. You could really see this through some of what was going on at CDC. There was a lot of hope that some of these new tools could be used to really improve the lives of people throughout the world. So there's sort of this groundswell of optimism that was occurring then that I'm not sure has been replicated since. So that was part of it. A lot of the staff that was involved, they were carrying vaccines over through the jungles, and they were negotiating with warring parties. And there was just a lot of determination to get this over the finish line. All countries were on board with it. The WHO playing a key role in terms of the coordination hub for all of it.
I feel like I've had conversations with people working in public health about how the technology is there, but having a successful public health campaign is so much more than that. It's about trust as well as the technology. I feel like we're at a point where we have the vaccines we need. Obviously, we could always have more, but the lack of public trust is perhaps a bigger issue at this time.
Yeah, I mean, that is so hard. Even in one country, the U.S., imagine scaling that across the entire world.
It's crazy. And it's crazy that Americans and the Soviets were collaborating during this time. The Cold War was in full swing when they decided to work together. If you've ever seen a photo of a child covered in smallpox, the collaboration, to me, it starts to make a little bit more sense.
I wish that it were about the benevolence of wanting to help these children, but I'm pretty sure it was more about the political factors. Nelly said that this was a project that was mutually beneficial for them at a time where they were both trying to demonstrate their technological and political influence. So in this case, the Soviets were the ones who developed a heat-stable vaccine that could be used and transported around the world. And the U.S. were leveraging their leadership and resources to help distribute the vaccine.
What about all of the other countries that had to buy in?
This is where the World Health Organization was super instrumental. You can probably imagine not everyone in the world is the biggest fan of the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So Nelly talked about how at this point, even though the World Health Organization personally didn't have a lot of resources, it had a lot of trust from different countries.
What WHO provides is a forum for the health ministers of all countries to come together. It has an annual ministerial meeting every year at the World Health Assembly, but also it has regional offices and it has on-the-ground staff that's in constant contact with country staff, so that it really is one of the few ways that health services can get to places that literally have none. Having the WHO as the focus point and the coordination hub for all of it was critical to the success of the program. So it really took an organization like the WHO being at the center of it for this to come about.
At that point, the WHO, which is the health advisory body for the UN, had developed a ton of trust internationally. So even if a country didn't like the US, they would trust the WHO.
The U.S. is now talking about dropping out of WHO. It's going to lose that umbrella that it was able to work through in places that are not necessarily keen on the U.S. So that's going to be a problem.
I definitely see it in my reporting. There is a widespread lack of trust in institutions that used to be respected and had the resources at one point in time to coordinate the large-scale effort that you need when you're tackling a problem like this.
I would say there was one silver lining that Nelly shared, which is that for all the weakening of global coordination and trust that we have right now, the WHO did manage to pass a pandemic treaty in May of this year, which created principles for addressing future pandemics more equitably.
Google says the word treaty is meant to signify a legally binding document between countries, which sounds very official. But I've also heard that international law is weaker, less enforceable than national law. So I do wonder if it's more of a symbolic effort than anything.
It's a good point. I mean, the WHO never really had any binding power, and maybe all of their power in the past came from mutual trust that doesn't exist anymore. But I really feel that when we are working to organize all these little stepping stones that we put in place today, like the pandemic treaty, it might end up being useful 5, 10, even 20 years down the line. So I think it's something where we should genuinely take the wins where we see them, because they might end up being instrumental down the line.
That's true. I'm really glad that smallpox is no longer. Who else did you talk to, Lena?
So I was trying to brainstorm different examples of successful collective action, and one that I came up with was Wikipedia. And Wikipedia was really interesting to me because it feels a lot more decentralized than the way that we normally think about collective action, where maybe we imagine more intentional movement building, some activists coming together and forming a broader coalition. Wikipedia formed in a much more decentralized way. It all happened on the internet, and yet it still resulted in something that I feel is quite positive for the world. So I talked to Kevin Lee, a friend of mine who has actively been editing Wikipedia for over a decade. And he also served for 4 years on Wikipedia's arbitration committee, which is often described as Wikipedia's Supreme Court.
Two thoughts for me. The first is that it's awesome that there's a Supreme Court out there that isn't just staffed by 75-year-olds. And the second thing is that I have wondered for my whole life who has been editing Wikipedia articles. So it's really exciting to put a face to a name.
I think that there's something so wholesome about wanting to contribute to this public encyclopedia on the internet. And these are all volunteers.
You know what? I remember the days when teachers would repeatedly say it's not a reliable resource. And I definitely saw that change over time, where now it is seen as not a bad first step into researching something. Maybe it's not the only thing you should cite if you're writing a paper, but definitely it's seen as a reliable resource. And that wasn't the case when we were much younger.
Yeah, that is something that Kevin really talked about when I asked him what contributed to Wikipedia's success.
There have been these distinct eras over time, right? Wikipedia was founded in 2001. In its early years, there were literally late night comedian segments where I think Stephen Colbert once famously roasted Wikipedia for espousing WikiTruth, which is the truth that anyone can edit or something like that. And it was really only over the course of many years of evolution that it became something that you could reference without people laughing at you. And, you know, I think a few things have contributed to that history. One of them is that the overall context of the information ecosystem really changed. There was a time when the only reputable places to go for information were literally places that published, that there was a publishing house and you could sue them if they got something wrong. And at least it was real identifiable people writing, you know, news articles and textbooks and so forth. And that really shifted alongside Wikipedia as it grew up. But the other thing that's changed, of course, is that the editorial standards really started increasing over time. You know, there was a time when you could just register an account and write the article on humans or Earth or something. And then that would be Wikipedia's article on Earth. And for one thing, we already have an article on Earth now, so you can't write that. But even if you could, there are all these policies governing verifiability and point of view and the use of primary sources versus secondary sources and stuff like that that really came to mature over time and I think has grown up well with the project.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Yeah, what do you feel like are some of the standards that were really important to helping Wikipedia grow in credibility?
Every Wikipedia page has a talk page. When you go right up to the top, and there's a little button that says talk. Probably most people have never even noticed it, but they are fascinating documents, which document the entire history of like what people have debated about this article. And a fun exercise might be to go to Donald Trump's article, click on the talk page, and you can see there's actually this whole list of discussions that have reached conclusions about what the article should say. Mm-hmm. You know, that the article should include this word or not that word, and that this is a fair way to characterize something and this isn't. And all of those discussions are available for everyone to see. So you're asking a little bit about what gave Wikipedia its credibility over time. I think that the transparency and the, you know, very online nature of every single one of those content decisions is a big part of it.
Actually, that gives me a lot of hope, because I feel like sometimes when we talk about like the devolving of social media, the conclusion is we should just talk to people in real life. But I think there are ways that the online community can be really positive and really productive in discussion. It doesn't just devolve into Twitter bots fighting each other.
That's really cool. I feel like I can say with confidence that as a reporter, a lot of traditional news media is not that transparent when it comes to those decisions. Decisions about when to report on something or what made it into the final story, like those are all closed door discussions. And there are reasons for that, but I think a lot about how reporting on something lends legitimacy to it. And so obviously there are things that slip through the cracks. It might be cool to have some sort of documentation of that in the same way that Kevin talked about for Wikipedia.
Yeah. I love behind the scenes things. You look at any like journalism movie and they're like, how do you know this is true? And then they're like calling all these different sources to verify stories.
Yeah.
And I feel like they do a good job of dramatizing that process, which is honestly pretty boring. And it just involves emailing and talking to a million different people. But maybe journalism would really benefit from more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. They really skip the parts where you mostly get ignored. But sometimes it really is that dramatic. It's nice to see that on the silver screen.
I also was really interested in what this looked like on more contentious topics, on more political topic pages on Wikipedia. Have you seen a shift in those pages over time as our broader information sphere has become more polarized?
That's a really good question. The thing that makes Wikipedia often quite hard to run is that there is an article on Donald Trump, and it's not that you can write multiple different pieces with multiple different perspectives. Facebook has the luxury that your Facebook post doesn't have to agree with everyone else's Facebook post. But on Wikipedia, it's not like everyone gets to write their own version. There's just one consensus product. And so, yeah, in some ways, these are some of the hardest pages to write, because they have to reflect some shared agreement on what they should say. Sometimes people ask me, oh, has it gotten worse with the politicization? And it actually hasn't gotten that much worse. And in fact, I think that our American politics articles have become some of the best articles that we have. Because what makes the consensus process work really well is participation from a broad set of people. You know, and a broad set of people who are familiar with and are committed to applying Wikipedia's editorial standards to make the encyclopedia better, of course. But our articles tend to get better when there are more eyeballs on them, not less.
Mm. So this last thing that Kevin said really surprised me, and it's probably the thing that has given me the most hope in all of these conversations. there's this general feeling that opening conversations up to everyone, especially on the internet, and involving more people in the discussion results in less productive conversations. That's like the whole reason why corporations exist and elected officials exist, is we think having fewer people in the room is more productive and it's easier to make decisions. So the idea that involving more people in the conversation on Wikipedia makes the system work better is so wonderful. And it's so emblematic of what we want collective action to be, where it's almost like a multiplier effect, where more discussion results in more understanding, which results in more discussion and more understanding.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. And I'm not being sarcastic about that.
I also asked Kevin if working with Wikipedia over the years has impacted his optimism about collective action in general.
Yeah, outside of Wikipedia, I spend my time in policy. And so I think about this like top-down frame of how to achieve change. And working with Wikipedia has made me remember that the bottom-up frame is also really an important way that change happens in the world. Wikipedia wasn't established by starting from, you know, square zero and thinking, oh, what are the policies that we are going to have as a website? And then how are we going to find the right people to do that? It started with the people and then resulted in the policies and structures that make the project function. And so it's a good reminder that the grassroots action is sometimes the most effective one.
I feel like it's a more forgiving model, like that these policies can evolve through also this collective decision making. Right. Whereas in like politics, when you pass a policy, it's so hard to pass a policy that all the work has to go into making sure the policy is working, or like trying to prove that the policy is working rather than continuing to iterate on it.
Yeah, very much so. Every time I remember just how it is that we made Wikipedia, I get a little bit more inspired.
The thought of collective action as an alternative structure to decision-making in a really top-down culture is a great way to wrap up this episode. It reminds me of how the WHO has all of this soft power that is really important, but actually doesn't have real resources in terms of money and staff. And because of that, it can't actually exert any power through threat. It has to be genuinely bought into.
I think a lot of us are susceptible to the idea and the fantasy of a hero swooping in to save the day. I think it's a very American thing to love superhero movies, for example. But collective action provides us with an out and an alternative to the savior narrative. Also, I will never get over the fact that Americans and Soviets worked together once upon a time. I know it was for their own benefit, and I know it won't happen today, but I think if it happened once, it can happen again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, not the Soviet Union, but I believe that countries can work together in specific circumstances. Another thought that I'm left with is that collective action is not a panacea. It is hard and slow, and you need a central organizing structure. And even with all of that, you have to get lucky. When we started this podcast, I was like, this cannot be a self-help podcast.
No.
But there's this thing that self-help gurus will talk about that's like preparation plus opportunity results in luck. That idea of preparation plus opportunity is something that I think about with these community structures. It's not always going to be clear when you're creating these central organizing structures what it's going to be useful for, but when the timing is right, it's something that can be so powerful. So I think I just want to leave this episode with a parting thought from Seb.
I was like, well, I guess it matters that we get these jobs back. That's what we're working tirelessly for. But the very fact that we're here together is a testament to just how powerful these movements can be.
Thank you so much for listening to this first episode of How We Hope, a show distributed by Grab Bag Collab. Did our show make you feel more hopeful? Did it bring up any feelings of doom? Either way, we'd love to hear your thoughts in our inbox, howwehopepodcast@gmail.com.